You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Life's better with American Family Insurance, because our home policies help protect your dreams and come with peace of mind. Save up to 25% by bundling home, auto, and life. American Family Insurance. Get a quote, find an agent at amfam.com.
Products not available in every state. Discounts may not apply to all coverages on an auto or home policy. Discounts do not apply to life insurance policies. Visit amfam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating companies, American Family Life Insurance Company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.
Hello and welcome to the Critics Table. Every episode, we are joined by three luminary theater critics as they review the latest shows on and off Broadway. You may agree with one, all of them, or none at all, but we ask that you listen first and ask questions later. Let's join the table, shall we?
Welcome to The Critics Table, a new podcast where we discuss the hottest shows on Broadway. I'm Juan Michael Porter II. And today we'll be discussing American Buffalo. But first, let's talk about some of the places where we are writing. I write for Theaterly, New York Theater Guide, TDF Stages, and Queerty.
Hi everyone, I'm Christian Lewis. I write for Did They Like It As Well, Theater Mania, Theaterly, and recently got to write for Playbill and Variety.
Hi, my name is Ren Xia. I write for Did They Like It, there's a theme here. I also write for Theaters Easy, as well as Exeunt NYC. Yeah, that's about it.
Awesome. Before we jump in, let's hear a quick synopsis of what American Buffalo is all about. American Buffalo premiered on Broadway in 1977, received the New York Drama Critics Circle Award for Best American Play, and officially established David Mamet as one of the major new playwrights of the second half of the 20th century. It went on to be nominated for the Tony Award for Best Revival of a Play for the 1983 production. The play was subsequently revived off-Broadway in 1981, on-Broadway in 1983, and off-Broadway at the Atlantic Theatre Company in 2000. So, first of all, what are our initial reactions?
I am not a David Mamet person, I will admit that. I was on the Twitter consensus that was not very excited when this was announced. As your synopsis told us, we've had quite a few productions of American Buffalo as it is, so getting another one was like not the most exciting thing. And when I saw it, I'll just say it certainly did not change my opinion of this play or of David Mamet. Was not a fan at all, was not really understanding why we were doing this revival. I didn't really like feel like I gained anything in seeing this play about three men scream at each other and scam things and use slurs about lesbians and say really bad things on stage. I didn't really gain anything from this production.
I think there's a little bit of a, maybe I was in the minority of having gained something from seeing this particular production or this play, not necessarily, which is not to say I gained something in a positive way as a human being, but being someone who got introduced to theater via British plays and European sort of more varied styles of theater, I was never really introduced to David Mamet's oeuvre, nor was I super familiar with quote-unquote classic American plays, American Buffalo being one of the most famous ones that I've always heard about but never read or seen a production of. So this is actually my introduction to David Mamet at all. So having seen that, I definitely felt a sense of, oh, this is why Trump still served Big Macs at banquets. Because there's a level of, this is the comfort food of what a certain subset of American theatergoers are comfortable or familiar or like crave for. So that was my first impression.
That's a really great point. I have to admit that I was coming into this with his comments about predators, teachers being predators and groomers in my mind. And as an educator, I found that offensive. But then I remembered that his first wife, Lindsay Krause, actually owns the rights to the play, and that in a sense, he was trying to sabotage it. So I tried to reset my mind and see it. And what I took away from it was this very cynical view at how men are constantly trying to outmaneuver each other. And to your point, Ran, it reminded me that this is sort of an American perspective of a dog-eat-dog world. I just found it initially tiring and left feeling bored.
Yeah, it's kind of surprising. This is a rather short play, but it has an intermission, and I'm was also shocked that in such a short play I could feel bored and that it could feel very long. I also, just to the point about American masculinity that you both are making, I just think it's kind of like lazy to have a play where it's like, here are three male characters who are toxic people, and that inherently is a commentary on masculinity, where I don't think it is, and I think that's kind of like a lazy playwriting device to just put three angry men on stage and say, we're commenting on American masculinity, where I'm like, are you, or did you just like not have the creativity to like invent something else and explore this in a more complicated way with other types of characters?
Weirdly, I was thinking about how the junk shop is a perfect setting, because none of the stuff in a junk shop is actually useful, and you're kind of ruffling through all of that junk trying to figure out some kind of value. And the American Buffalo itself is, it's a coin, right? Does it actually have any sort of practical value, or is it more of this nostalgic symbol of there is something there if we dig deep enough, if we fine comb through this text, there is something relevant we can discover here, as opposed to just three men rapping angry thoughts to each other. And in the end of this, not even 2 hour play, nobody was really changed, or nothing really substantial has happened.
It's interesting that that defines it classically as a tragedy, that change does not occur, that it's all the same. We're in the same place that we left, and I'm not surprised by it either. I don't necessarily think that theater needs to edify one, and I was sort of surprised by how much it seemed that Mamet was willing to pull people down. And a part of me would like to think that, oh, well, this is his way of saying that we need to tear down this idea of what masculinity is, but I don't think that's true, actually, because there is no real investigation of who these people are or why they do what they do. It stays very surface level, and at this point in time, I want more from theater than that.
Yeah, that's a really great way to put it, that I want more than this. And when all the characters are kind of just like equally bad people, it's also hard to kind of like have a takeaway of, oh, did someone learn something, or was something specific the critique here, where when everyone's this toxic mask person and has a lot of really bad traits of yelling at each other and greed and sexism and homophobia, it's like, what are we, is this a critique, or are you just showing three people being like this?
Being from Southern California, like, I have to say that, like, I like being around like really scuzzy, terrible people, because I can be a very terrible person who says like awful things. And what gets me about that is that how unfun it was, that it was just like, oh god, enough already. And I'm curious if we have any ideas about what worked for us, what stood out, any performances?
I actually thought there was some hope in terms of vulnerability and complexity in a lot of those characters. Specifically, I feel like Sam Rockwell's teach, kind of piggybacking on your question of standing out performance, he does that type of volatile kind of braggadocio of a character so well. But then there was a lot of interesting vulnerability that bleeds into it. So you see that puffer fish, you see that kind of porcupine sticking out of him that's from a place of insecurity. And I thought that was an interesting aspect of masculinity that could have been poked a little bit further. So I wonder what possibility there can be.
Yeah, to me, there was a similarly, Sam Rockwell was definitely the strongest, and there was felt like this kind of like weird hierarchy thing where Sam Rockwell was definitely giving the strongest performance and felt very natural in a Mammoth play. Like it really worked. His style really matched. He fit the dialogue in a way that felt natural. Lawrence Fishburne was good, but not as good. Darren Criss, who I usually love, felt like kind of aimless here and didn't like commit to a lot of the choices enough, such that his character just felt like kind of dopey and not in the drug way, which he probably should have been more dopey in the drug way. And to me, I think a big issue, and it's how we start the play, is that Fishburne and Criss, the dialogue felt so like a shtick in their mouths and in their bodies that for their first very long extended scene of all the what, where are you going, what are you talking about, the thing, what thing, are we doing the thing, did you get it, where's my cough, it was like, please just stop, this is like never ending, no one talks like this, this is like coming across as like a joke and it shouldn't be as much of a joke as it is. And I think the two of them really needed Rockwell to like balance everything out. So the scenes that he was in worked much better for me.
That makes me think about the direction, the through line, about what worked well for Rockwell is that he actually had a forward narrative. And I don't think of that character as a leading character. I think that the performance allowed it to lead. I felt that Fishburne was quite sedate. And, you know, interestingly enough, even though he's a black man, I felt I don't know any black men like this. And my guest actually was half black, half Italian, and said, like, to his point, he was like, is he playing him as a white man? Because this feels very much so like this just happens to be a black person in a role for a white person, which is very strange, because there's no reason why Fishburne couldn't be a character in this play and black and respond to the N-word, you know what I mean? And yes, that part where I thought, really? You don't? Okay. So I felt that I think that Rockwell definitely drove things, but it's more to me that there's not a lot in this. So we're extrapolating things about what it could be and looking at what he did with it, but there's just not a lot within it to do. And certainly not from the direction perspective. I didn't think that Neil Pepe, the director, had a real idea of who the characters were, that it was sort of like, okay, you guys do your thing, because we've all seen the movie of like His Girl Friday, we're like, well, what are you talking about? I'm doing this. Okay, sir, what, like that sort of thing. But you see the actors come alive and imbue that style with a sense of personality. And for the life of me, the only personality I found was through Rockwell. The rest of it was submerged.
I was shocked when I learned, because I'm not like a David Mamet devout person, to know that David Mamet and Neil Pepe have worked together a lot of times, and that Neil Pepe has directed this play before. Because when I left, I was like, Neil Pepe clearly just like doesn't get this play, doesn't get David Mamet, didn't know what to do. But like, nope. Apparently just like was really like phoning it in or not really giving a lot of direction here, in my opinion.
I was thinking about how it was a kind approach to stage these characters on the 2022 stage, because It probably had to do with a lot of aspects of, like we've been talking about, toxic masculinity and how difficult it must be to stage this play right now. And we are in that junk shop. We're still like, I think this is the play that forces you to try to dig through the junk and see like, where is the value? And I don't know, I mean, as a director, this is probably not the play that I want to direct. This is probably a play that I want to give to my acting student in an acting class, because there's a lot of juice, a lot of meat in there for them to perform. But specifically for male actors, which makes me want to shy away from that as well, because, you know, you need, like, as a director, I prefer to find characters that could fit a more varied combination of performers, as opposed to like, here are three straight men, or not necessarily. I feel like there are different variety of personality that can be developed from all three of them. But I wonder, like in a classical sense, and going back to earlier, like the conversation in the beginning of the play, it felt very much like, whether we want to believe it or not, this play has become a mold or like a basic recipe for a lot of, like a whole generation of playwrights, because I have seen so many plays written following that formula. And I feel like a lot of playwriting classes use those kind of scenes, acting classes use those kind of scenes to provide a point of entry. And I really like hope we can jump out of that mold.
Hear, hear. Thinking about the design elements, lighting, costume, I want to give a shout out to Didier Ite, who at the drama desk we just gave a special award. She has basically clothed half Broadway, it seems, and off-Broadway. And the one thing I have to say is that she made Sam Rockwell's Tushy look quite, yes. Anything else that stood out to you all about the overall design?
Yeah, I loved her clashing patterns with Sam. I loved he was always in like striped shirts and plaid pants, and I thought that was really good. I feel like a lot has been talked about with Scott Pask's set design for this show. For those who didn't see it, this show was at the Circle in the Square. It's a theater in Thrust on three sides, so the stage is this like rectangle that's surrounded. And Pask made it a very, very claustrophobic version of the junk shop. There is stuff everywhere. There's stuff from the ceiling. I would love to know the like small amount of cubic feet that the actors actually have to work with, because they are in like these tiny little alleyways, which is a challenge for them. And I've heard people say that like that was a really great design choice. I found it to be a very frustrating design choice to limit your actors' movement that much. I also think that it was not a great design choice in the sense that at the performance I was at, there's a couple stage combat moments and Sam Rockwell got a little carried away and was flailing himself and Darren Criss about, and like props went flying into the audience on two different occasions. The audience is very close. There's a lot of loose props. It felt like dangerous and too cluttered for the way that this play needs to work. So I personally was like not a fan of the set design for that. The sound design, whoever did it, the like rain sounds were like so good that while I was there, I was convinced that it was actually raining outside. They did not even list a sound designer, which is very bizarre, but whoever did that, good job on the sound design. And also the like moody lighting for the second act, good on that.
I really appreciated the texture of the design for this production, from really all of the element, the auditory to the textile of the set itself. It gave me a more cinematic feel, even though the ceiling aspect of the set was more installation based because of, you know, there's a stylized and elevated level of that junk shop. But it did remind me of a lot of the junk shop that I kind of vaguely explored in the Midwest region. The lighting was beautiful with, you know, all of the chandeliers on top of there. I did got a little bit confused during the interval at going into the second act because of the time lapse. I wasn't sure if anybody else got that feeling of like, I wasn't sure how much time was meant to have passed not having read the play.
Did you feel like the lighting helped that or made that more confusing for you?
It was a little bit confusing because I thought, because I wasn't sure if second act is going to be like a different day or later that day, which goes back to like maybe we didn't need an intermission at all. Right, because of all of the lighting change, I thought maybe a day has passed because I didn't read the play before.
Yeah, it's supposed to be the first act is supposed to be in the morning, like getting breakfast, and the second act is 11 o'clock at night when they're like meeting for their rendezvous. And the only reason I remember that is because I have a playbill with me, and apparently they wrote it in the playbill, which is nice, but not enough people read those. They talk about time a lot. I would have even loved a simple gesture of putting a big clock somewhere on stage and like moving the clock to give you a little hint for you like Ren if you didn't know when it was.
to that point about time and Playbill and when, it didn't come through clearly in the production design. I'm thinking about Morning Sun, a play that was at Manhattan Theater Club, where the lighting is very clear about the passage of time, and I wish there had been something to incorporate that. And, you know, looking at the set, I do want to say that aesthetically, I enjoyed it, but Dave Harris, playwright, has said that we all know this is fake, this isn't real life, and that the actors have to do something with it. And what they were given to do was hazardous, to your point, Christian. And I can look at this aesthetically and be like, oh, this is what it's like to be in a real junk shop, it's so beautiful, and yet think, wow, these actors might really hurt themselves or someone in the audience because it hasn't been put together in a way, or they haven't been given enough time on that set to where they can actually function without possibly getting hurt. And with that, I'm wondering what our...
But I want to say this is because I think the concept of that design is... based on the experience of actors. So the experiential aspect of the design was actor-driven and not audience-driven. So instead of creating an environment where the audience could feel like they're inside of a junk shop, the actors, while performing on stage, they feel like they're in a junk shop, which for us, looking outside in, we are not going to necessarily feel that level of claustrophobia. And at the same time, they are kind of, all of their movement are going to be limited because, you know, for that design choice. I wish there could have been a little bit of more of a, embrace the installation nature, embrace the suspend disbelief, and expand that junk shop to incorporate the entire space and involve us. I don't know.
Yeah, I would have liked that much better because I was just so confused the entire time of why this is in the circle and the square. It's actually my favorite Broadway theater. I think it's the best space we have on Broadway, and it's the coolest space we have on Broadway, and it's the only space on Broadway that lets us do cool things in that way. And to basically just like ignore that and be like, well, I guess I'll design in the thrust because I have to, was like upsetting, and I felt like it was a wasted space and that this production would have worked better in a proscenium, or like you said, Ryan, like make it a little more immersive and put like props throughout the whole space, or even the whole ceiling would have even helped extend it a little bit, but like no attempt made to like use that theater as that theater.
Our final thoughts. I wrote this in my Queerty review, that this is essentially a 5-minute writing exercise that goes on 85 minutes longer than it needs to.
Oof. I wrote this in a different review, but this certainly confirmed the t-shirt slogan for me of less Mamet, more Vogel.
I said perhaps the real tragedy is the fact that American Buffalo remains relevant today at all, but is it truly still the gold mine from which we attempt to dig up the real America, or a junk shop for us to rummage through the value and relevance? So it is indeed a junk shop, which I'm glad I passed through. But whether or not I bought anything or took anything away of value remains the question.
Well, thank you so much, everyone, for joining the Critics Table. I'm Juan Michael Porter II. If you'd like to follow me on Twitter, I'm at Juan Michael II for the second.
I'm Christian Lewis on Twitter. It's at C Lewis Reviews.
I am at Rhino Riddler on all of the social media platforms.
Thanks for joining us on this episode of the Critics Table podcast. We would like to thank Jose Solis and the BIPOC Critics Lab team, who has generously partnered with us on this project. You can find out more about the BIPOC Critics Lab at BIPOCCriticsLab.com. Also, be sure to subscribe to this podcast so that you never miss a review, and learn more about our critics at bpn.fm/critics table. The views or opinions expressed by the critics in this episode are solely their own and do not necessarily represent views or opinions of the Broadway Podcast Network. See you next time.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. Suf's The Original New Musical from Shayna Taub is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at suffsmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on Essie Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com. The Outsiders, Essie Hinton's generation-defining novel, is now a powerful and moving Broadway hit that the New York Post is calling the best new musical of the season so far. Don't miss your chance to join Ponyboy and the Greasers and experience the classic story come to life in a whole new way. The New York Times calls it refreshing, gritty, and endlessly effective. So get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com, and of course, stay gold. They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Suffs. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Suffs celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Suffs has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suffsmusical.com.